Good evening. Welcome to the Slayer Report. Today is Thursday, June 14th, 2018. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Hold that date, September 22nd. Dr. Skidmore and I are going to be at the Biltmore Estate in Asheville, North Carolina. We're going to have lunch with Catherine and Dr. Mark Skidmore. I'm going to be in Vienna, Austria in the first week of July. If there's anybody in Europe interested in coming over for lunch or dinner, let me know at either customer service at Slayer.com or ask Catherine at Slayer.com. And we will go ahead and set it up. I'm working on a possible lunch or dinner in Friesland in the Netherlands sometime in August. If you have an interest in that, let us know as well. And then, of course, I'm going to be in Italy for the Scientists for Peace conference in October. Ulrich Gonagher will be joining me there, and that's going to be a very interesting time. I'm also doing an interview with Greg Hunter tomorrow. We'll record tomorrow. He'll put that up early Sunday, so keep a lookout for that. Our theme tonight is something big is happening. We've been operating, I've said many times, on the Bretton Woods trade system globally in a unipolar model since the end of World War II, and that model is now being shifted. Somebody accused last week Trump of foreign policy by demolition. Whether high speed or low speed, whether nice or rough, it's changing. We watched in the beginning of June last week the co-location, same time, the Bilderberg meeting with the Vatican present, much greater government ministers present. At the same time, you had the G7 meeting, and then at the same time, you have the NATO defense ministers meeting all at the same time. TrueStream Media did a great video about it, and it's up in our slider. If you go up to the homepage and go to editor's picks, you'll see the TrueStream video among our Just a Taste video. So let's look at the many big things in addition to the all three meetings of Bilderberg plus Vatican, G7, NATO defense ministers happening at the same time. Trump left the G7 meeting a bit early and headed for Singapore, where he had the summit with North Korea. Big question is, has North Korea now agreed to come into the Bank for International Settlements tent? If it has, that's a very big step, along with what's happening in Syria. Russia may be making sure Syria comes in very nicely. Everybody gets in the Bank of International Settlement tent, and then the financial system can go through to a whole new level. That's what a lot of people are talking about, the reset. And yes, it looks to me like it, we've really started into that period. Very big development. The net neutrality repeal went live this Monday, June 11th, and in combination with the 5G rollout, we're talking about a major shift in how internet access and telecommunications is going to be controlled and handled. This gives the large private telecommunications companies to manipulate content in very bottom-up kinds of ways all throughout the internet, and to do it well within the law. It's pretty frightening. I would point out that every time we've taken a major step of change in the telecommunications system, something happens. The 1996 Act was the condition precedent to really bubbling the housing market, sucking all the capital out, and globalization. The tower infrastructure all got completed in August 2001, and I remember saying to myself, something big is about to happen. And of course, we know what that was. 9/11 happened, and all the efforts to get the missing money dealt with went kaboom. Interestingly enough, the Wall Street Journal announced that the private equity and LBO firms are sitting on over $1 trillion of cash. And you want to ask, the connection to $7 trillion missing from DOD and HUD in 2015 is? We'll talk a bit about that more later. The U.S. economy is clearly expanding on an enormous repatriation of cash. My guess is some of that repatriation and tax cut is air cover for the reinvestment of the financial coup proceeds. So we're basically watching the laundering of our own money back into the economy, and as well increase in defense budget, easily financed with some of those financial coup proceeds back being laundered back through Treasury. The reset is upon us. I had a great interview with Rob Kirby this week on the missing money, which we'll publish after we do News Trends and Stories with Dr. Farrell. And one of the things he talked about was the hyper curve of money creation. If you don't believe Rob, go look at the Chapwood Index, which is an index of sort of household expenses. We're clearly running 8 to 13.5%, depending on where you live in the United States. I don't have any numbers for Europe or Asia, but there's no doubt inflation is upon us, and that hyper curve is happening. You hear wherever you go the move and the push for sound money. The Swiss just turned out a referendum on sound money. It didn't get a lot of votes, but getting it on the ballot was enough to put the fear into a lot of people about the fury that citizenry are feeling all over the world watching their currencies and their cultures be debased. Interestingly enough, speaking of major debasement, a UT professor came out with a major study pretty much proving that the Bitcoin prices were clearly manipulated, pump and dump. You heard it at the Solari report long ago, but we're glad to see serious academic research confirming it. Another indication that we're ready to go to the post-financial coup phase is the surge in ESG. It's a ESG is a term of art. If you go back and read the third quarter 2016 wrap up, we did a whole theme on the growth of ESG. E stands for environmental, S stands for socially responsible, G stands for governance. It's basically analysis that looks at the impact of investment on non-return criteria, basically what I call total economic return. What's the return to the whole economy? Anyway, it's a condition precedent to letting the private corporations run just about everything. JP Morgan announced that they're going to hire, or it wasn't an official announcement, one of their people said they're going to hire 1,000 wealth advisors, and DOJ is hiring 300 U.S. attorneys. There's a connection. The more you concentrate wealth into a few hands and do it by basically using government as a criminal enterprise to do it, the more you have to stomp down with control. And the more cash you bring in and the richer you make the economy, of course, the more you need enforcement for central control. So neither one of that, as far as I'm concerned, is a good development. Most important, and I'm just, again, running through the big things that happened that tell you something really is up. Elon Musk did an interview this in the first quarter, which I just posted on the website, warning about AI. I'm going to be talking a great deal with Dr. Farrell. We'll publish it next week in News Trends and Stories Part 1. The top story for the quarter is the AI invasion. I'm going to spend a lot of time on it. It's something I really want you to understand, because if we all have one risk, it's that. It's the invasion of AI and the use of AI to engineer much tighter central control. And so it's not just AI, but who's regulating, controlling, engineering the AI and what their goals are. The AI invasion accompanied with the rising interest rates that we're experiencing, the Fed just bumping in again this week, is really a triple squeeze play on household budgets. And so expect to see a new wave making life difficult for the middle class, despite the sort of increased employment, et cetera. There's no doubt that with all of this going on, there is, even though you have enormous engorgement from the success of the financial coup and many, many players enjoying, with the repatriation of cash, tremendous opportunity to make money and double down on their power and money in the sort of Fortress America scenario, there is serious fear of the Midianite thing happening. And for those who are interested in seeing Clinton prosecuted and frustrated with the sort of ability, we now see the DOJ IG come out and be very critical of the FBI handling of the investigation of Clinton and the use of email, but not recommend any kind of forceful action. For those who are frustrated by that, please understand that the Clinton network was basically a pay-for-play syndicate that was operating on behalf of and working for, you know, the investment syndicates that essentially run the country, if not run the world. And they were the ones who were governing and managing the financial coup, and the Clintons were facilitating all sorts of actions and things happening and making that go, including what in essence was the privatization of the government and its assets. So essentially one way to look at the investment networks that I'm talking about, you're talking about the endowments at the Vatican, you're talking about the university endowments, which is Harvard, Yale, the University of Pennsylvania, it's the Ivy Leagues, plus Stanford and some others. And they're very much financing and being governed and managed by the private leadership of the private equity and LBO firms, hedge funds, other Wall Street firms, a big presence of Hollywood there. It's a very dense network. And they have a lot of reason to want to stop fighting and not let fighting get out of hand. Remember, When you fight with threats of criminal liability, if things get out of hand and what I call a Midianite thing happens, for those of you who are new to the Salier Report, Midianite refers to the story of Gideon and Judges in the Old Testament. If you look up the story of Gideon on Wikipedia, you can read it. But basically, the Midianites are an occupying army of Israel, and they end up killing each other. They jump up in the dark and not being very trustworthy and trusting of each other, they kill each other. So it looks to me like the smart money people are very concerned that the fighting not get out of hand, particularly when you're playing with legal enforcement, criminal liabilities all around a major amount of money. Interestingly enough, just as the IG report from the Department of Justice comes out with a softball for the Clintons, the New York AG announces that they're basically going after the Trump Foundation, and Cohen's law firm drops, or Michael Cohen being attorneys, the personal attorney for Trump, their attorney announces they're dropping Cohen while Mueller is putting more pressure on Manafort. Anyway, the swamp drama just looks ever, ever more vicious. And you got to give Trump credit. He just keeps plowing forward, and that's what you have to do. But it's a very ugly picture, and it shows you the extraordinary concern, I think, for the investment syndicates of the need to kind of manage this process and focus on the next phase as opposed to letting the cleanup of the liabilities get out of hand. If you look at who a breakdown in the pay-for-play network would jeopardize, one of the things it could jeopardize is we saw $7 trillion leave the federal government in 2015. Now, that's the number of the undocumentable adjustments. Who knows what the real number? The statute of limitations on RICO is 10 years, so the bailouts are not yet quite protected. Now, that does not necessarily, to do something about this does not necessarily require legal action. If you got enough consciousness in America about what's been going on, the pension fund trustees could certainly take action, and many of us could take action to stop the U.S. government essentially being able to launder money out of our savings. The whole game should shift, but the reality is nobody wants to jeopardize the Fortress America plan, and with tax reform done and huge amounts of capital flowing back into the country, everybody's kind of licking their chops. But they're also taking big steps to make sure that they don't have risk. I've mentioned Harvard management laying off its in-house staff and outsourcing. They're cleaning out the knowledge. It's a very astute risk management technique when this kind of phase is over. Same with Lockheed Martin. You saw my post, Lockheed Martin cuts and run. They're spinning out some of their government contract operations. The New York Fed is using its fireplaces on a Saturday night. We wonder what that is about. I'm assuming it's a special shredding technique. The $64,000 question, of course, is what will the 35,000 alleged indictments and 300 U.S. attorneys be used on, and will it come down this fall? There's been a lot of chatter this week, including at Salieri, about the two suicides. I can never remember, Anthony Borden and Kate Spade. They certainly look very suspicious. The explanations are not very satisfying. There's no doubt that during a period like this, somebody who starts to talk and make trouble can be at real risk. So it would not surprise me to see those as some kind of interference there, if not assassination. I got a request from somebody, did Larry Kudlow have a heart attack? Was that part of the problem? No, I suspect that it's just a very difficult transition for Kudlow to go from a very secure sort of position that he was master of the art to something as stressful and as difficult to have any kind of control or feel effective as the White House is right now. It's a very difficult place to work, given extraordinary changes that you're implementing. Remember, you're turning the model globally, and everybody's trying to adjust, and no one has a clear vision of where you're going, so it's bumper cars. Anyway, and I think the serious fear of the Mennonite thing taking over can make for a very, very tense environment. The ultimate metaphor for all of this happened. I almost fell off my chair when I first read an editorial in the Wall Street Journal by Paul Levy, the former chair of the University of Penn Law School Board and still, trustee emeritus on the Penn Law School Board, apparently a major donor, had been long been the chair for a long period of time. But I just happened, while I was preparing this theme of something big being up, I read his resignation letter, which had gotten posted on the internet. I doubt he expected it to go public. Anyway, he resigned over the relatively new dean of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, removing a professor from the teaching schedule who had criticized university policies regarding minority students. And for me, it's essentially a free speech issue. I don't agree with what the dean did, but one of the things the dean did is he refused to publish the facts about law school performance of minority students. So he, in essence, censored the facts you needed to see whether what the professor was saying was accurate or not. And certainly, you know, I think the board's request that the facts be made public is perfectly reasonable. Now, what's interesting is Mr. Levy did not resign for the last two decades over the bankrupting of a generation or two of students with student loans or a lot of other things that have gone on both in the university or around the university, which I think are much more serious than whether or not this professor maintained their teaching schedule or not. In the process of his letter, what was very interesting is he said many glowing things over the former dean of the law school until about 2 years ago, who just happens to be my brother. Now, here's what's interesting about this. Before I go on, I just want to give you some disclosure regarding my history with the University of Pennsylvania. My maternal grandfather was the dean of Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania. In fact, I was told he was asked to be president, which he declined. My father was a professor of surgery and chairman of the Department of Surgery at the University of Pennsylvania, and was also very involved in raising funds for the university endowment. I graduated from the University of Pennsylvania with a BA in history and then graduated with an MBA from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. I was a member of the graduate executive board of the Wharton School for a period of time and a member of the board of overseers of the University of Pennsylvania School of Arts and Sciences. I was a member of the board of directors of the Wharton Business School Club of New York and a member of the advisory board of the Wharton School Club of Washington. While I was on Wall Street, I donated a term chair, the William T. Fitz Jr. Term Chair in the School of Arts and Sciences. And I was a founding member of the Trustee Council of Penn Women and raised what was then a significant amount of funds for the council and the university. So in the early 2000s, when I was litigating with the federal government, one of my challenges was that my company's insurance carrier required an attorney to essentially police them. And my uncle was good enough to finance these costs until the company won our case in the Court of Claims and subsequently settled, at which point I was able to reimburse him his financing. During this period, however, the University of Pennsylvania kept soliciting me for donations. I had been writing articles critical of the Harvard Corporation and Harvard management and the policies that they were implementing or promoting that were very harmful, I felt, to the taxpayer, but certainly making the endowment lots of money. There was, unfortunately, a very win-lose relationship between, I felt, Harvard management and the U.S. taxpayer. Anyway, I realized it would be very hypocritical to not also at least look at the financial statement for my own university. So the next time that Penn solicited a donation, I wrote and asked them for the last 3 years of tax filings, which are required by law to be public. I received nothing except a new solicitation for donation. So I asked my attorney to write to Penn on my behalf. What I got, instead of the supposedly publicly available tax filings, was a phone call from a relative screaming at the top of their lungs, and I assure you, the meanest and harshest of terms. They had just gotten a call from my brother, who was then the dean of the University of Pennsylvania Law School. She claimed that he had just been pulled on the carpet by the provost of the University of Pennsylvania. And if I did not stop requesting the university's public financial disclosure, the relative claimed, my brother would be fired as the dean of Penn Law School. Consequently, if I did not promise to cease requesting Penn's tax filings, they would call my uncle and arrange for him to cut me off. Well, of course, the implication was if I lost my lawyer to please the insurance company, I'd lose the insurance carrier covering my legal expenses, and, you know, and then the results would be seriously dire, including not winning the settlement, which I was ultimately able to do. The government owed my company money, and ultimately I got a great deal of that money back. Now, I suspect the reason that my brother did not call is that he did not want to make the request on behalf of the provost. Instead, I don't think it was the provost. I think it was the large donors who funded the law school and the university. I'd be very curious to know. I'd love to get Mr. Levy's opinion on this, or truthful opinion on this. And if the full truth came out on the relationship of those donors with the mortgage securities fraud, subprime mortgage bubble, and growth of private prisons and related gentrification and the criminal efforts to falsely frame me, my guess is my brother's involvement in threatening to arrange for the loss of counsel could easily involve the breaking of one or more laws, you know, not to mention what the RICO statute might find with a true deposition of what really happened. The reality is I never looked at the University of Pennsylvania endowment operations, but thanks to my brother, I did not need to read the financials to know what I would find. I had a pretty good, idea based on what I'd seen at the other universities, and I'd never seen fear like that from any university, including Harvard Corporation. The reality is my personal experience with my brother is that he doesn't believe in the law. And that's the kind of person that Mr. Levy had appointed as the dean of the University of Pennsylvania Law School. However, as Franklin Sanders says, he pines for the treats of the tapeworm, which is why I have not spoken with him for more than a decade and don't ever expect to speak with him again. Which brings us back to Mr. Levy's resignation huff. Mr. Levy has not resigned over a wave of financial coup bailout and housing bubble proceeds running into Penn. Alan Greenspan is a major donor at the University of Pennsylvania. Mr. Levy did not resign over, as I said, a generation of Penn students being bankrupted by predatory student loan lending and inflated university tuitions. And I doubt if he was involved or if he was told of it. Mr. Levy, as chair at the time, would never resign over his dean conspiring to threaten a former trustee and alumnus of the university to keep university endowment and financial management secrets. Apparently, it's okay to keep the financial management endowment secret, but it's not okay to keep minority performance secret. Anyway, here's the reality. The financial coup was managed by investment syndicates that included the university endowments. They included private equity, they included LBO, they included hedge funds and other money managers that govern and manage them. If you look at the flow of funds laundered through Madoff, that never bought securities but instead went right out through the JP Morgan door, I think you'd be surprised to see how much were donated to one or more universities. And I would note that $6.5 trillion went missing from DOD and several hundred million from HUD in 2015. The Wall Street Journal announced that private equity and LBO firms, as of this morning, this is in the Wall Street Journal this morning, have over a trillion dollars in cash to invest. It's a remarkable coincidence. And in fact, Carlyle is mentioned. I note in the Dylan Reed book that when money started going missing from HUD in the mid-90s, late 90s, just as I started to litigate with the Department of Justice, Carlyle suddenly started announcing the raising of miraculous amounts of money. It was quite impressive because it was such a young, experienced firm to be shifting billions into Asia, but suddenly money was coming out of the woodwork and into Carlyle. But then, as the president of CalPERS said in the spring of 1997, they're moving all the money out. Starting in the fall, they're moving it to Asia. Anyway, if you're interested, see the Dylan Reed story. So it's important to connect the dots. If you haven't read my piece on the pension funds in the annual wrap-up, it's a great place to pick up this thread and see the big picture on what was going on. So something big is happening. The financial coup was successful. The U.S. financial leadership is engorged with cash and resources. They're all jazzed about getting even richer and more powerful, building Fortress America. They're bringing all the money home, or not a lot of the money home. If you look at stock charts from around the world, you know, U.S. is flying, everything else is falling, with rare exception. And what they're having is they're having a big squabble over who's going to control this next period. But whoever controls, and no matter how much they fight, the big money is going to make sure, they're going to try, that the Midianite thing does not threaten the engineering of the reset they're planning. And I would point out, as the fires in Santa Rosa proved, they're moving fast and they have no time and interest in your rights or your opinion. They have failed to engineer a war with Russia so far, but their efforts are far from over. Money and markets. The U.S. dollar index has held that 92 line. It's up 2% for the year, trading in and around a little bit under 94 right now. Fed meeting bumped the interest rates and indicates they're going to do it twice more this year. If you look at where interest rates have come, the 10-year treasury over the last year is up 100 basis points. 30-year is only up about 25 basis points, so it's still well within the 150 basis point range. I'm always telling you is what the stock market can digest in a 1 year period. The yield curve is relatively flat, so the 10-year is at about 2.85%, and the 30-year is at 3.1%. So pretty flat, and I think the market in the world can well digest this. This is going to get more earnings into the pensions, the insurance companies, and the banks. It's going to be good for savers. It is going to put a squeeze on small business as the money rolls back in, and of course, corporations with much lower cost of capital, very much engineered by fiscal and monetary policies. So anybody with a stockpile is going to be earning more money, and I think that's good for capital allocation. At the same time, Kirby's right, the derivative positions mean that they cannot take big rises. So I think the risk of a big spike in rates is small. And if you look at there are many, many very big risks on the horizon. One is the AI invasion. Another is war. But they're really on the other side. The big risks are really on the other side of the balance sheet. I don't see interest rates as being a problem. If you look at fixed income, the long treasury ETF TLT is now down 5% for the year. The intermediate's down 3%. The bond aggregate's down 2.34%. And junk's still flat for the year. I don't know how junk does it. It just keeps rolling along. The S&P now up 4.6% for the year, so much stronger this week. Home builders still down. They're down 7.5%. The European ETF, VGK, is almost flat. It's up 36 basis points. Germany is down 1.73. It looks better than a lot of the markets around the world. The developed world minus North America is flat. China now only up the large caps, 2.27. Small caps still doing very well at 10%. Emerging markets down 2.59. Ever since the end of January, that chart just looks terrible. Commodities up 2.65% thanks to the Chinese. Cotton is doing very, very well, of course. So I live across from the Hickory Valley Cotton Gin. Always nice to see cotton have a good year. Gold is flat. It's down 37 basis points for the year. And silver is looking a little bit better. It's up 0.5%. And gold oil is doing really well, up 16% so far for the year. So, you know, everybody's expense budget is getting squeezed with the price of energy going up and the price of capital going up. So everybody's getting their expense squeezed globally. I just wanted to mention we have a financial markets plugin with currencies, commodities, and the markets, stock markets around the world. At the bottom of the page on the right, we didn't have it on the old website, but it is on the new website. We had a problem with the service, and it's now working again. So you'll only see it when you log in, but when you log into Solaria, you can get a really nice little roundup of all the markets. I really enjoy using that plugin, so I encourage you to do it. The G7 meeting in Canada marked a real deterioration in relationship between the U.S. and Europe and between Canada and the United States, and that's not good to see. Europe and the United States need each other, and I'm sure that Trump is looking at the cash flows on the Bretton Woods system and saying, you know, we have to renegotiate this, we have to re-engineer it. And the question is how to do that. I think I mentioned earlier one group said, I think it was The Economist, this is foreign policy by demolition. And certainly Trump came out today with tariffs on the $50 billion of tariffs on China, coming off the, I call it the post summit glow. It was quite a, you know, it was sort of a summit by a reality TV show host. The results were very conceptual. Everybody felt great. Now it goes to the, you know, to the government itself, the two governments, to work out the details, which is easier said than done. But I would say the G7 summit was very hurtful to the relationships between the Europe and the US. And the question is, given where the cash flows are, can we get to a positive place to understand that? I think we'd really need to see the cash flows. In the meantime, May has her hands full in England with real rebellion around Brexit. Now we're talking about a soft Brexit, not a hard Brexit. We're going to see a lot in the next 6 months. And so I don't trust the coverage in the United States. And I'm really looking forward to being in Europe in July and August and getting a better understanding of what's going on there. The courts cleared the AT&T purchase of Time Warner. And so AT&T is speeding ahead. AT&T has had a very plush week, not only with the court basically checkmating the Department of Justice and the administration, and DOJ apparently is throwing in the towel that the administration won't continue to oppose it. But that happened just as AT&T won big on the repeal of the net neutrality went forward. We've seen states turn implement state legislation to try and undo the repeal of the rules that the FCC promulgated for net neutrality. We saw a push to get the Senate to pass legislation, draft legislation, but no, the House would not move on it. The House sat on it. So the House is basically, and the Republican Party is basically checkmated every effort to prevent that. And so between the telecommunications winning very, very big on Monday with that repeal marching forward, the courts supporting AT&T on Time Warner is another big, big success for the telcos. And we see right after the court rules that Comcast jumps in on the Disney acquisition of a portion of Fox. It's really Fox Entertainment coming in with a higher offer and all cash. Disney was paying stock. So the moral of the story, I think, is that, you know, you can basically shred up the antitrust laws. It really does look like anything goes. And of course, the danger with anything goes is it means the privatization of the internet, even the end of the internet, as anything other than control and corporate profits. We're going to have to see how it plays out and whether or not the consumer can push back hard enough, and sort of the IT and software community push back with enough innovation to just make it impossible for the big guys to basically destroy the place. The good news in all of this is the mini night thing is really happening. One of the things forcing these kinds of consolidations is technology is squeezing their cash flows. Their overhead is threatened. They're very nervous at the same time that they're having to compete up against a rising industry in all these areas, both content providing and distribution in Asia as a result of the rise of the Asian consumer. We'll talk a lot about that in July in the second quarter wrap-up. There's no doubt that one of the reasons Time Warner needed to do something is cable is failing. And the plummeting of their cash flow. So this comes from weakness, not from strength, and the desire to go to Washington and rig all sorts of things that bolster your cash flow and give you the ability to basically rent seek in the economy in a way which is dreadful for the economy, dreadful for the consumer, dreadful for the taxpayer, but good for a few telecommunications companies. The attitude is if we can rig it through Washington, then we will do so. And shame on the Republicans and shame on Congress. This is frightening to watch. I wanted to also mention that in the scheme of really scary, we're watching the rollout of other digital data laws, which are, of course, making the internet a much more complicated, expensive, and difficult place to be. Hopefully they make a positive difference, but it may turn out to be a difference for censorship. We have a new, in addition to the European GDPR rules, which seem to have added a great deal of complexity, there's a new copyright proposal. I put up an article about a group of very impressive internet pioneers and very much respected leaders, everyone from Vint Cerf to Jimmy Wales and Tim Wu, coming out with a joint letter against a proposal from the Europeans. It's called Article 13. Let me just read it. By requiring internet platforms to perform automatic filtering of all the content that their users upload, Article 13 takes an unprecedented step towards the transformation of the internet from an open platform for sharing and innovation into a tool for the automated surveillance and control of its users. Anyway, very scary looking. And as I said, we need massive innovation and a real shift in consciousness to let the dinosaurs fail and not take us down with them. It's gotten bad enough that The Economist just put out a great big warning about surveillance state. They're focused on China, but their hints throughout their articles now are broader concerns. I noted in the, I think in the last wrap-up about their warnings about driverless cars being able to shut off access to different places. So there's no doubt that you're talking about the data beast getting more and more central control. And the frightening thing is we as taxpayers are paying for it, but it's being used to, you know, we're funding the infrastructure, and now the top 1% is using it basically to centralize control even further. And with the financial coup over and successful, they have every reason to want to keep the money and keep everybody off balance. We'll talk again a lot more about that. That's part of the AI invasion with Dr. Farrell. Our hero this week is Dr. Mark Skidmore. He's someone who hates to be called the hero, but he's going to be called the hero this week. He has a new update on the missing money. You can go to missingmoney.salieri.com. Just click on the DOD and HUD section, and you'll see an update right at the top. The DOD came out with a new report on the undocumentable adjustments and did something I have never in my life seen with a public statement or financial report by an inspector general at a federal agency. They redacted all the numbers, every number. Take a look at it. If you go read his report and then just look at the new report under DOD for 2017, you'll see it. It's just breathtaking. Let's go to the movies. I wanted to address a movie, Nobody Speaks, Trials of a Free Press. that explores the growing tensions between the concentration of wealth and free speech, but it looks at it through the prism of two recent events, which both of which have very interesting aspects, but basically defy simple explanations. The first is the bankruptcy of Gawker as a result of a litigation judgment that was financed by Peter Thiel, who had been hurt by basically press in the Gawker. And if you look at the case, it's complex. There's a great interview with Floyd Abrams, the first the free speech amendment attorney, who does a good job of explaining why maybe the lawsuit wasn't such a great idea. You almost wish that Peter Thiel had been able to talk with Abrams before he decided to do it. At the same time, sites like Gawker I find to be horrifyingly mean. And that level of meanness, although I think it should be protected by free speech, is a serious problem. If you look at the Hogan sex tape that it published, it was slimy. It's slimy for private people to invade someone else's privacy. It's slimy for that tape to be sold. It's slimy for the institution that publishes it. And I think the question is, how do we deal as a society with that level of meanness and slime? There's another, the case of the Las Vegas Review-Journal purchased by the Adelsons and really causing a mass exodus of very talented journalists is a different kind of a story, and it is a really clear story of the concentration of wealth versus good journalism and the financing of good journalism. Unfortunately, it has interviews with a Washington Post journalist and other journalists who talk about their institutions as though they're reputable, and it's very difficult for me to think of the Washington Post as reputable. And you realize that this journalist doesn't know. They don't know the extent to which they are guilty repeatedly of major material omissions and real fake news. You know, they don't know. It's quite astonishing. But when you see their level of ignorance, you realize that, you know, the acculturation to fake news is very, very bad. There is a good story, and that is I put up a review. I wrote a review of Bad Blood, which is by a Wall Street Journal investigative reporter who has done a remarkable job on the Theranos story. And one of the things it points out is that the company that owns the Wall Street Journal, the largest shareholders, Rupert Murdoch, who lost $100 million as a result of the Wall Street Journal sort of outing the company, and he was pressured to basically censor the Wall Street Journal. He didn't. The editors didn't. It's really a remarkable story of the editorial process really working with integrity, and you take a look at it and you think, oh my God. You know, and it's funny, one of the things I say in the review, when Murdoch bought the Wall Street Journal, I thought, oh, well, there goes the rand, there goes the franchise. And the reality is the journal's just gotten better under Murdoch's leadership. And you see, I've never seen any kind of indication of any compromise of the editorial board. Now, maybe I just didn't notice, but it looks to me like the journal's gotten better. Anyway, so Rupert Murdoch gets a huge gold star, if you can believe that. It looks like he doesn't need it. He's about to get many more billions because he's selling Fox Entertainment. And now with Comcast rolling in with all the Fortress America money, it looks like he's going to get an exit on Fox Entertainment, which is quite, quite juicy. Our interview tonight is Harry Blaser interviewing John Rappaport on his philosophy. They call it the cosmology of John Rappaport. Many of these are topics we've covered with John before, but Harry felt that they were spread out in countless number of interviews, and he thought it was unbelievably important to get, he wanted to sit down with John and just get him to talk about his philosophy in one interview, and it really was very delightful. Ask Catherine. Dear Catherine, I've noticed a theme in listening to a couple of your interviews where you talk about an infrastructure being put in place before something happens, i.e. shopping malls at airports, and your Sheriff of Nottingham example. Over the past several years, local municipal and county courts in Washington and other states have been switching to online filings and total electronic filing systems. It is great because it's so convenient. You don't have to go to the courthouse to file. This has also allowed the federal government to have real-time knowledge of minor crimes and charges in local municipal courts. I've had colleagues finalize cases for their clients, undocumented immigrants, to have ICE waiting for them in unmarked vans outside of the city courthouse. Without a word, the ICE agents take them away. They have real-time tracking of local municipal court systems. Here's my concern. This system will get turned on the rest of the population. It's only a matter of time. There are books about the federal laws being to the point that the average person commits 3 felonies a day. Washington's Department of Licensing has created a labyrinth of administrative rules and procedures that all amount to misdemeanors and gross demeanors if not followed. What if somebody pays off a fine for you? Did you pay a tax on that? What if the penalties are forgiven, taxable event? Will you be deemed will you be able to go through an airport because Homeland Security has deemed people with unpaid tickets a threat? China has already started a program where people with debt programs problems are banned from travel. Already in the United States, the IRS can have your passport revoked if you owe taxes. There is no guarantee that you will get it back timely once the taxes are paid. That will hamstring the Bitcoin investors who are dinged with gotcha taxable events. Finally, the federal government has announced that if you have a prescription for medical marijuana, you cannot buy a firearm. Marijuana is a class 1 controlled substance. This begs the question, what happens when you go into your doctor's office and it is placed into your electronic medical record that you suffer from depression and are on certain medications that may be associated with violent behavior? I write this in the hope that maybe someone has an idea of how to push back against this Orwellian centralization of information and governmental power. Thanks for all you do. Was there ever a second spiritual warfare interview with Franklin Sanders? I love his perspective. These are all excellent points. I want you to take this question to heart. The first thing I want to say, I don't care how much you file things online, you need to keep a paper copy. And I say it again and again, he who archives writes history. You need to have documentation. If you don't want to keep it in a hard copy, then keep digital copies offline in hard disks with air gaps in safe safes. You need to be able to document and prove you own your assets, you are who you are, et cetera, and you do not need to get tricked into electronic filing systems, electronic statement systems, and not have independent copies. This is incredibly important. Please invest in documentation and knowledge management. It's exceptionally, exceptionally important for legal matters and legal reasons, taxes, finances, compliance. It goes on and on. So particularly if you are filing things online, please keep copies, and not just in online form. You need to get them off into a redundant and very secure place. That's number one. The second thing is, when it comes to compliance, anything you can do to live in a place where the rules are less complex, different states are different. It's one of the reasons I now spend a lot less time in California than I used to. I'm very much concerned about the 3 felonies a day in any state where there is very high complexity of rules and regulations. So that's another thing you can do. The last thing you can do, whenever anybody asks me who my doctor is, I write none. And that's why you do not want to give legally power to any person to write anything in your file. If I say, you know, Harry is my doctor, or Joe Smith is my doctor, if Joe Smith writes something in a file, it's considered true, whether or not it's true. I just had somebody complain to me about a doctor writing something in their file that wasn't true, and they asked the doctor to take it out of their file and then asked for their record again, and they hadn't taken it out. And I said, look, you've got to write a letter and you've got to document legally two things. One is, you've got to inform that doctor in writing that they are not your doctor. And number two, that you have asked for it to be taken out because it's not true. You never said it. And you need them to take it out, et cetera. And you need to have a legal document and paper trail. So, and then finally, on any expert that you hire or use, whether it's a attorney, a CPA, a doctor, you need to go to serious lengths to make sure it's a person of great integrity. Because remember, there are enforcement obligations and powers. If you go to a CPA, that CPA now has laws and regulation that basically make them an enforcement arm of the IRS. So always make sure you understand that when you're dealing with an expert, number one, you need a person of very high integrity. But number two, you need to make sure that you are doing everything clean and on the up and up. Do not play fast and furious with regulations and the law. You know, we are in a gotcha environment. It's very dangerous. And finally, really, really focus on people of integrity throughout your life. Throughout the economy, there are whistleblowers and snitches who make money literally making up lies about you and turning you in. So be very, very careful. And don't bring people into your life who think it would be fun to make money, you know, basically setting you up for a sting. We did a great Salieri report at the beginning of 2017 with Howard Root talking about a QI-TAM whistleblower lawsuit, just of the kind that I faced. And, you know, you had a snitch who was trying to make money by basically telling lies. So you've got to be exceptionally careful. It's one of the reasons Howard Root decided to sell his company. He said, you know, in this kind of environment, I cannot be responsible. You know, there's no way I can micromanage sufficiently to protect against this kind of situation if enforcement is going to be operated in the way that it was in his case. Anyway, so those are a couple of rules for the road, and I'll spend some more time working on helping you do this. I'm talking with a variety of people about doing Salieri reports on just this topic. But it's exceptionally important for you to, and I would encourage you to go back into the archives and listen to our Salieri report on who's your sheriff. It's very, very, it's a great blessing to live in a county where the sheriff is lawful and supportive of the citizenry. And I think it really pays to know your sheriff and local law enforcement and to support them legitimately as you can. Okay, I'm going to say a lot more, as I said, about the AI invasion. That's going to be the number one story in my discussion with Dr. Farrell, and we'll publish that. We're going to publish it early this quarter because I think it's so important to get this material out to you. Another question, can you comment on the implications of the Time Warner merger with AT&T and Comcast? Last-minute bid to stop Disney buying Fox. Seems communication mind control mergers are eating the world to fill the tummies of telcos who must satiate the data beast. I think you said it best. I mean, one of the reasons both of them are fighting deflation, they have big overheads, and cable is losing customers right and left. The mobile revolution and competition and technology is deflating both the content providers and the distributors. Now, with the repeal of the net neutrality rules, they basically can jack up the rents. I mean, this is a real rent-seeking operation, among other things. And so part of this is just everybody trying to make money as the world changes and technology sort of eats away at their revenues. So this kind of consolidation makes sense. At the same time, you know, the danger, of course, is you are building an infrastructure for more central control. And, I think the your statement of mind control mergers is pretty appropriate. And it concerns me because, as I said when I opened up, every time we see one of these big moves to build up the data beast, you know, the world shifts in a way that's unpleasant for humans. So we definitely have, this is definitely consolidation of power by the data beast. It's almost as though the data beast is coming another step out of the closet. And then as an aside, Australia excludes China from providing equipment for Australia's soon-to-be 5G wireless networks. Not surprising. Dear Catherine, this is one from one of my favorite subscribers whose nickname is Rebel Commander. Thinking of writing a book called The World is a PSYOP. All of the people who take CNN or Fox News as a political reality make me laugh. It's so important to stay in a state of amusement. Then a comment that someone sent to the Aim for Truth group. And they did an interview with Harry and then proceeded to really be pretty nasty about me. I didn't have a chance. You know, everybody kept sending me their videos and I just didn't have a chance to listen to it. But, I, you know, I think they're a little bit into the hope porn for me. Anyway, so I've kind of avoided them since, but I will. Somebody just sent in another video from them, so I'll listen. Someone sent me something from the a petition to the Australian government complaining about what the real legal structure was and wanted to know if this was a template for Native Americans or all Americans. There's no doubt we need transparency on what the real governance structure is, what the real legal operations are. But I think first and foremost, we need to follow the money because the money really shows you where the power lines are. Another subscriber sent in an end from one of Saker's latest pieces. I put the link up, but I want to read it because I think it's so good. He's talking about the deal cutting that's going on in Syria. It's a wonderful article because it's really describing the, you know, the bizarreness of what's going on. And remember, Syria is very much part of the seven countries in 5 years that's all going to get us into the BIS system so we can do a global financial reset. So the pressure is on to clearly resort what's going on in Syria along with North Korea. And of course, it all takes you back to Iran. Let me just read what Saker wrote. Finally, there is the single most important fact. The Anglo-Zionist Empire and Russia remain at war and have been so for at least 4 years or more. That war is still about 80% informational, 15% economic, and 5% kinetic. But it is a very real war nonetheless, and it is escalating. As long as Russia will retain even partial sovereignty, and as long as she will offer an alternative civilizational model, even an imperfect one, she will remain an existential threat to the empire, and the empire will remain an existential threat for the entire Russian civilizational realm. While hugely important to Israel, the entire Iranian issue is just a sideshow to the transnational leaders of the empire who see Russia and China as the real main competitors, especially when joined in a symbiotic relationship as they are today. Hence the crises in the Ukraine and on the Korean Peninsula, hence the constant warnings of a possible full-scale war. Even if Putin succeeds in moving the EU closer to Russia and away from a clearly insane USA, and even if he succeeds in preventing the Anglo-Zionists from directly attacking Iran, this will only further convince the Anglo-Zionist leaders of the empire that he, Putin, and Russia are the ultimate evil which must be eliminated. Those who hope for some kind of modus vivendi between the empire and Russia are kidding themselves because the very nature of the empire makes this impossible. Besides, as Dmitry Orlov correctly pointed it out, the empire's hegemony is collapsing fast. The empire's propaganda machine denies and obfuscates this, and those who believe it don't see it. But the leaders of the empire all understand this, hence the escalation on all fronts we have seen since the neocons retook power in the White House. If the neocons continue on their current course, and I don't see any indication whatsoever that they are reconsidering it, then the question is only when, where this will lead to a full-scale war first. Your guess is as good as mine. My one disagreement with Saker, as I keep coming back, is what's going on in space and with the space weapons, because I think ultimately that's a very important piece of how strong the Empire's hand is. And of course, that information is not accessible, just like the University of Pennsylvania's endowment information is not easily accessible, and the Department of Defense true financial statements are completely and utterly inaccessible. Okay. Okay, so I'm headed out tomorrow on the long drive to Joseph's house. I get to spend the weekend with Dr. Joseph Farrell. Oh, you be jealous. It's such a great experience. We're going to have dinner tomorrow night, chew our way through the AI invasion, and which is the first of our top 20 stories. We'll be covering the first part one. We'll publish next week. That's going to be the economy, financial markets, and geopolitics, and then culture and science and technology, space, all the other juicy things the following week in part two. Normally, we wait till the end of the quarter, but I think we have so much to say that's so important to say. I don't want to get it to you right away because I really want you to have the perspective you need to see the rollout of what's coming. I think it can really make a big difference. And then, of course, in July, we'll do the rise of the Asian consumer, our theme, and equity overview. We've got a lot of good stuff coming up. Ulrich Groniger is going to be doing her next Future Science, the Wave Genome. If you look at the dazzling changes that are happening in science, it's one of the reasons the change is accelerating. Harry Blaser did a great interview with Bill Nyman called Hog Heaven. I've interviewed Rob Kirby on The Missing Money. It's called How Would We Write the Movie? And it's designed to help understand what's really going on with The Missing Money. And then a great interview with Daniel Post-Senning of the Emily Post Institute on manners. Salary Report subscribers are a remarkably well-mannered bunch, but I wanted to make sure we all had inspiration as to how to inspire children, grandchildren, people we love, and those around of us who are falling into the uncivil society, inspire them to come back and remember that manners are the basis of a successful society, a successful business, a successful family. There's nothing, it's very interesting, of all the years that I worked as an investment advisor, one of the lessons I learned is marry somebody who's kind. The difference that a kind household makes to your health and wealth over many decades is absolutely extraordinary. But you know, when you work with many, many families and you see the results of those good habits over many years, what a difference it makes. So ladies and gentlemen, until next week, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there's a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Good night and good luck.